Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding by David Hume, first published in 1748. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Section 5. Skeptical Solution of These Doubts. The passion for philosophy, like that for religion, involves a certain danger. Although it aims to correct our behaviour and wipe out our vices, it may, through improper handling, end up merely encouraging us to continue along lines that we're already naturally inclined to follow. We may set out to achieve philosophical wisdom and firmness, and to become satisfied with the pleasures of the mind, yet reason ourselves out of all virtue, as well as all social enjoyment, ending up with a philosophy which, like that of Epictetus and other Stoics, is only a more refined system of selfishness. While we meditate on the vanity of human life, and focus our thoughts on the empty and transitory nature of riches and honours, perhaps we are really just indulging our natural laziness, which, hating the bustle of the world and the drudgery of business, seeks a pretence to put reason in control. However, one kind of philosophy seems to run little risk of this drawback, because it doesn't join forces with any disorderly passion of the human mind, and can't mix with any of our natural tendencies or inclinations, and that is the skeptical philosophy. The skeptics always talk of doubt and suspending judgment, of the danger of deciding too quickly, of keeping intellectual inquiries within narrow limits, and of giving up all theorizing that isn't in touch with common life and practice. So their philosophy is as opposed as it could be to the mind's idleness, its rash arrogance, its grandiose claims, and its superstitious credulity. This philosophy has a humbling effect on every passion, except the love of truth, and that could never be carried too far. Given that this philosophy is almost always harmless and innocent, it's surprising that it should so often be criticized and stigmatized as libertine, profane, and irreligious. Perhaps the very feature that makes it so innocent also brings hatred and resentment against it. It doesn't encourage any bad feelings or habits, so it has few supporters, but it does oppose many vices and follies, which is why it has so many enemies. This philosophy runs no risk of undermining the reasonings that we use in common life, no risk of carrying its doubts so far as to destroy all action and belief. Nature will always stand up for itself, and prevail in the end over any abstract reasoning whatsoever. That is, we shall continue to think and act in the ways that our human nature dictates, the ways that are natural to us, with no risk of our being deflected from these by philosophical considerations. For example, I showed in the preceding section that whenever we reason from experience, we take a step that isn't supported by any argument or intellectual considerations. But these experiential reasonings are the basis for almost all the knowledge we have, and there's no chance of their being dislodged by the discovery that they can't be justified by arguments. If we aren't led by argument to make inferences from past experience, we must be led by something else that is just as powerful, some other force that will have power in our lives as long as human nature remains the same. It would be worthwhile to explore what that other force is. Suppose that a highly intelligent and thoughtful person were suddenly brought into this world. He would immediately observe one event following another, but that is all he could discover. He wouldn't be able, by any reasoning, to reach the idea of cause and effect, because, firstly, the particular powers by which all natural operations are performed are never perceived through the senses, and, secondly, there is no reason to conclude that one event causes another merely because it precedes it. Their occurring together may be arbitrary and casual. There may be no reason to infer the existence of one from the appearance of the other. In short, until such a person had more experience, he could never reason about any matter of fact, or be sure of anything beyond what was immediately present to his memory and senses. Now suppose that our person gains more experience, and lives long enough in the world to observe similar objects or events occurring together constantly. Now, what conclusion does he draw from this experience? He immediately infers the existence of one object from the appearance of the other. Yet all his experience hasn't given him any idea or knowledge of the secret power by which one object produces another. Nor can any process of reasoning have led him to draw this inference. But he finds that he can't help drawing it, and he won't be swayed from this, even if he becomes convinced that there is no intellectual support for the inference. Something else is at work, compelling him to go through with it. It is custom or habit. When we are inclined to behave or think in some way, not because it can be justified by reasoning or some process of the understanding, but just because we have behaved or thought like that so often in the past, we always say that this inclination is the effect of custom. We are not offering custom as the basic reason for the inclination. We are merely pointing out a fundamental feature of human nature, which everyone agrees is there, and which is well known by its effects. Perhaps that is as far as we can go. Perhaps, that is, we can't discover the cause of this cause, and must rest content with it as the deepest we can go, in explaining our conclusions from experience. Our ability to go that far should satisfy us. If our faculties won't take us any further, we shouldn't complain about this. We do at least have here a very intelligible proposition, and perhaps a true one. After the constant conjunction of two objects, heat and flame, for instance, or weight and solidity, sheer habit makes us expect the one when we experience the other. Indeed, this hypothesis seems to be the only one that could explain why we draw from a thousand instances an inference which we can't draw from a single one, that is exactly like each of the thousand. Reason isn't like that. The conclusions it draws from considering one circle are the same as it would form after surveying all the circles in the universe. But no man, having seen only one body move after being pushed by another, could infer that every other body will move after a similar collision. All inferences from experience, therefore, are effects of custom and not of reasoning. Custom, then, is the great guide of human life. It alone is what makes our experience useful to us, and makes us expect future sequences of events to be like ones that have appeared in the past. Without the influence of custom, we would be entirely ignorant of every matter of fact beyond what is immediately present to the memory and senses. We would never know what means we should adopt in order to reach our ends. We couldn't employ our natural powers to produce any desired effect. There would be an end of all action and of most theorizing. I should point out, however, that although our inferences from experience carry us beyond our memory and senses, and assure us of matters of fact that happened in distant places and at remote times, any such inference must start with a fact that is present to the senses or memory. A man who found the remains of magnificent buildings in a desert country would conclude that the country had once had civilized inhabitants, but without the initial experience of seeing the buildings, he could never reach this conclusion. We learn the events of bygone ages from history, but to do this we must read the books that give the information, and must carry out inferences from one report to another, until we finally come back to the eyewitnesses and spectators of these distant events. In short, if we didn't start with some fact that is present to the memory or senses, our reasonings would be merely hypothetical. And however strong the particular links might be, the whole chain of inferences would have nothing to support it, and we couldn't use it to arrive at knowledge of any real existence. If I ask why you believe any particular matter of fact that you tell me of, you must tell me some reason, and this reason will be some other fact connected with it. But you can't go on like this forever. Eventually, you must end up with some fact that is present to your memory or senses, or else admit that your belief has no foundation at all. What are we to conclude from all this? Something that is far removed from the common theories of philosophy, yet is very simple? all beliefs about matters of fact or real existence are derived merely from something that is present to the memory or senses, and a customary association of that with some other thing. Or in other words, having found in many cases that two kinds of objects, flame and heat, snow and cold, have always gone together, and being presented with a new instance of flame or snow, the mind is carried, by habit, to expect heat or cold, and to believe that heat or cold exists now, and will be experienced if one comes closer. This belief is the inevitable result of placing the mind in such circumstances. It is an operation of the mind that is as unavoidable when we are thus situated, as is the passion of love when we receive benefits, or hatred when we are deliberately harmed. These operations of the soul are a kind of natural instinct, which no reasoning or process of thought can either produce or prevent. At this point, we could reasonably allow ourselves to stop our philosophical researches. In most questions, we can never make a single step further, and in all questions, we must eventually stop here, after our most restless and probing inquiries. But still our curiosity will be pardonable, perhaps even commendable, if it carries us on to still further researches, and makes us examine more carefully the nature of this belief, and of the customary conjunction from which it is derived. This may bring us to some explanations and analogies that will give satisfaction, at least to those who love the abstract sciences, and can enjoy speculations that still retain a degree of doubt and uncertainty. As to readers whose tastes are different from that, part two of this section is not addressed to them. Ignoring it need not harm their understanding of the rest. Part two. Nothing is more free than the imagination of man. And though it is confined to the basic stock of ideas provided by the internal and external senses, it has unlimited power to mix, combine, separate, and divide these ideas in every way that can be described or depicted. It can invent a sequence of events with all the appearance of reality, ascribe to them a particular time and place, conceive them as really happening, and depict them to itself with as much detail as it could any historical event that it is certain really did happen. What, then, is the difference between such a fiction and belief? It is not that one special idea is joined to every proposition that we assent to, and to none that we regard as fictional. Why not? Because the mind has authority over all its ideas, so that if this one special idea existed, the mind could voluntarily join it to any fiction, and consequently, according to this account, it would be able to believe anything it chose to believe, and we find by daily experience that it cannot. We can construct a thought in which we join the head of a man to the body of a horse, but we can't choose to believe that such an animal has ever really existed. It follows that the difference between fiction and belief lies in some sentiment or feeling that goes with belief and not with fiction, a feeling that doesn't depend on the will and can't be commanded at pleasure. It must be caused by nature, like all other sentiments, and must arise from the particular situation that the mind is in at that particular moment. Whenever any object is presented to the memory or to the senses, it immediately leads the imagination, by the force of custom, to conceive the object that usually goes with it. And this conception comes with a feeling or sentiment that is different from anything accompanying the loose daydreams of the imagination. That has to be all there is to belief. If there weren't some feeling or sentiment that distinguishes the conception assented to from the one that is rejected, there would be no difference between them. If I see a billiard ball moving towards another on a smooth table, I can easily conceive it to stop on contact. This conception implies no contradiction, but still it feels very different from the conception of the collisions being followed by the passing on of motion from one ball to the other. If we tried to define this feeling, we might find it hard, if not impossible, to do so, like the difficulty of defining the feeling of cold or the passion of anger to someone who had never experienced these sentiments. Belief is the true and proper name of this feeling, and everyone knows the meaning of that term, because everyone has beliefs all the time, and therefore is at every moment conscious of the feeling represented by it. Still, it may be worth while to try to describe this sentiment, in the hope of explaining it better, with help from some analogies. In that spirit, I offer this. Belief is nothing but a more vivid, lively, forcible, firm, steady conception of an object than any that the unaided imagination can ever attain. This variety of terms, 5 of them, may seem unphilosophical, but it is intended only to express that act of the mind which renders realities, or what we take to be realities, more present to us than what we take to be fictions, giving them more weight in our thought, and more influence on the passions and the imagination. Provided we agree about the thing, it is needless to dispute about the terms. The imagination has command over all its ideas, and can join and mix and vary them in every possible way. It can conceive fictitious objects, with all the circumstances of place and time. It can set such fictions, in a way, before our eyes in their true colours, just as they might have existed. But this faculty of imagination can never by itself produce a belief, and that makes it evident that belief doesn't consist in any special nature or order of ideas, because the imagination has no limits with respect to those, but rather in the manner of their conception and in their feeling to the mind. I admit that it's impossible to explain perfectly this feeling or manner of conception. We can use words that express something near it, as I have been doing, but its true and proper name, I repeat, is belief, a term that everyone sufficiently understands in common life. And in philosophy, we can go no further than to assert that belief is something felt by the mind that distinguishes the ideas of the judgment from the fictions of the imagination. It gives them more weight and influence, makes them appear of greater importance, strengthens them in the mind, and makes them the governing principle of our actions. For example, right now, I hear the voice of someone whom I know, the sound seeming to come from the next room. This impression of my auditory senses immediately gives me a thought of the person in question, and of all the objects surrounding him. I depict them to myself as existing right now, with the same qualities and relations that I have known them to have. These ideas take a firmer hold on my mind than would ideas of something I know to be fictitious, such as an enchanted castle. They are very different to the feeling, and have a much greater influence of every kind, either to give pleasure or pain, joy or sorrow. Let us then take in this doctrine, in its full scope, and agree that the sentiment of belief is nothing but a conception, that is more intense and steady than mere fictional conceptions, and this manner of conception arises from a customary conjunction of the object, with something present to the memory or senses. It will not be hard, I think, to find other operations of the mind analogous to belief, on this account of it, and to bring these phenomena under still more general principles. I have already remarked that nature has established connections among particular ideas, and that no sooner has one idea occurred in our thoughts than it gently, imperceptibly, introduces its correlative, the idea that nature has connected with it. These natural principles of connection or association come down to 3 basic ones, namely resemblance, contiguity, and causation. These 3 are the only bonds that unite our thoughts and generate that regular sequence of thought or talk that takes place among all mankind. Now a question arises that is crucial to the present difficulty. Does it happen with each of these relations that when an object is presented to the senses or memory, the mind comes to have not only the conception of its correlative, but a belief in it, i.e., a steadier and stronger conception of it than it could otherwise have attained? This seems to be what happens when beliefs arise from the relation of cause and effect. If it also holds for the other 2 relations or principles of association, this will be established as a general law that holds in all the operations of the mind. As the first relevant experience, let us notice that when we see the picture of an absent friend, our idea of him is evidently enlivened by the picture's resemblance to him, and that every feeling that our idea of him produces, whether of joy or sorrow, acquires new force and vigour. This effect is produced by the joint operation of a relation of resemblance and a present impression. If the picture doesn't resemble him, or at least wasn't intended to be of him, it doesn't convey our thought to him at all. And when the picture and the person are both absent from us, though our mind may pass from the thought of the picture to the thought of the friend, our idea of the person is weakened, rather than strengthened, by coming to us through the picture. We take pleasure in viewing the picture of a friend when it is set before us, but when it is not in our presence, we would rather consider him directly than consider him through a likeness of him that is both distant and dim. The ceremonies of the Roman Catholic religion can be considered as instances of this phenomenon. When the devotees of that superstition are reproached for the ridiculous ceremonies it has them perform, they usually plead in their defence that they feel the good effect of those external motions and postures and actions in enlivening their devotion, and intensifying their fervour, which would decay if they were directed entirely to distant and immaterial objects, such as God. "We portray the objects of our faith," they say, "in perceptible pictures and images, and the immediate presence of these pictures makes the objects more present to us than they could be merely through an intellectual view and contemplation." Perceptible objects always have a greater influence on the imagination than anything else does, and they readily convey this influence to the ideas to which they are related and which they resemble. All that I shall infer from these practices, and this reasoning, is that the effect of resemblance in enlivening ideas is very common, and because in every case a resemblance and a present impression must both be at work, we have plenty of empirical examples that support the foregoing principle. We may add force to these examples by others of a different kind, bringing in the effects of contiguity as well as of resemblance. It is certain that distance diminishes the force of every idea, and that as we get nearer to some object, even though our senses don't show it to us, its influence on the mind comes to resemble the influence of an immediate sensory impression. Thinking about an object readily transports the mind to things that are contiguous to it, but it's only the actual presence of an object that transports the mind with a greater liveliness. When I am a few miles from home, whatever relates to it touches me more nearly than when I am 200 leagues away, though even at that distance reflecting on anything in the neighbourhood of my friends or family naturally produces an idea of them. But in cases like this, both of the objects of the mind, what it is carried from and what it is carried to, are ideas, and not the livelier kind of perception that we call impressions, so that the easy transition from one to the other cannot provide the sort of liveliness that can't be had unless an immediate impression is at work. No one can doubt that causation has the same influence as the other two relations, resemblance and contiguity. Superstitious people are fond of the relics of saints and holy men for the same reason that they like to have pictures or images, namely, to enliven their devotion, and give them a more intimate and strong conception of those exemplary lives that they wish to imitate. Now it's evident that one of the best relics that a devotee could procure would be something made by a saint. And if the saint's clothes and furniture are ever considered in this light, it is because they were once at his disposal, and were moved and affected by him. This lets us consider them as imperfect effects of the saint. Imperfect, because he didn't cause them to exist, but merely did things with them while they were in his possession. They are connected with him by a shorter chain of consequences than any of the things, human testimony, gravestones, written records, etc., by which we learn the reality of his existence. Notice that in each of these phenomena, the person believes that the correlative object does or did exist. Without that, the relation could have no effect. The influence of the picture requires that we believe our friend to have once existed. Being close to home can never stir up our ideas of home unless we believe that home really exists. Now I assert that this belief, where it reaches beyond the memory or senses, is of a similar sort, and arises from similar causes as the transition of thought and liveliness of conception that I have just been explaining. When I throw a piece of dry wood into a fire, my mind is immediately carried to a thought of it as making the flame grow, not as extinguishing it. This transition of thought from the cause to the effect doesn't come from reason. Its sole origin is custom and experience. And as it first begins from an object that is present to the senses, when I see the dry wood go into the fire, it makes the idea or conception of flame stronger and more lively than it would be in any loose, floating reverie of the imagination. That idea of the increased flame arises immediately. The thought moves instantly towards it, and conveys to it all the force of conception that comes from the impression present to the senses. It might happen by accident that when a glass of wine is presented to me, my next ideas are those of wound and pain. But they will not occur as strongly as they would if I had been presented with a sword levelled at my chest. But what is there in this whole matter to cause such a strong conception? Apart from a present object and a transition to the idea of another object that we have been accustomed to associate with it? This is all that our mind does in all our inferences concerning matters of fact and existence. And it is satisfactory to have found some analogies through which it can be explained. In every case, the transition from a present object gives strength and solidity to the idea to which the transition is made. Here, then, is a kind of harmony between the course of nature and the sequence of our ideas. And though the powers and forces by which nature is governed are wholly unknown to us, we find that our thoughts and conceptions have occurred in an order matching the order of events in the world around us. This correspondence has been brought about by custom, which is so necessary to the survival of our species and to the regulation of our conduct in every circumstance and occurrence of human life. If it hadn't been the case that the presence of an object instantly arouses the idea of objects that are commonly conjoined with it, all our knowledge would have been limited to the narrow sphere of our memory and senses, and we would never have been able to suit our means to our ends, or to employ our natural powers to achieve good results and avoid bad ones. Those who delight in the discovery and contemplation of purposiveness in nature have here a great deal to admire and wonder at. The theory I have offered is further confirmed by the following point. This operation of the mind, in which we infer like effects from like causes and vice versa, is so essential to our survival that it probably couldn't have been entrusted to the fallacious deductions of our reason. For reason is slow in its operations. Very little of it appears in early infancy, and at best, even in adults, it is extremely liable to error and mistake. It fits better with the ordinary wisdom of nature that such a necessary act of the mind should be secured by some instinct or automatic tendency that can be infallible in its operations, present when life and thought first appear, and independent of all the laborious deductions of the understanding. As nature has taught us the use of our limbs, without giving us knowledge of the muscles and nerves by which they are moved, so it has implanted in us an instinct that carries our thought forward, along a course corresponding to the course it has established among external objects, though we are ignorant of those powers and forces on which this regular course and succession of objects totally depends. End of section 5.